For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, so because we've taken a week off, why don't we go back to the two verses preceding our paragraph? We're going to start in verse 14. But let's go back to verses 12 and 13 because they're really the foundation that everything we're going to look at today is based on. So let's go back and read. It said, "So then, my beloved, just as you've always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence," he says, "work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it's God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure." Now that phrase, "work out your salvation," when you first hear it, it sounds like he's saying, work for this, earn it, you know, get creative and find a way to obtain salvation. It's on you to make this happen. But he doesn't say work for. That's not what this text says. He says work out your salvation. That's different. One thing that this author, Paul, he's the guy that wrote this letter to the Philippians. One thing that he's crystal clear about is that nobody works for and earns by working their salvation. Look at Ephesians real quick. It says, "By grace you've been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It's a gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one may boast." What is it to get salvation? It's like receiving a gift. Does that sound like working for something? This is just putting into the open hands, just coming to God and receiving something. He says it's not. It's not as a result of works at all. You know, I'm thinking back to when I became a Christian. It was realizing I've sinned, that I've offended God by the way I live, and that I need something called salvation. I need salvation from his judgment. I need right standing with him. And it wasn't something I had to labor and fight for. I just simply asked for it. If you're, you know, kind of reviewing your life and wondering where you stand with God, this is an important question. Have you at any point in the past just acknowledged to God that you're sinful and that you need salvation and called out to him and asked him, put your faith in him, trusted him to give you salvation as a gift? If you haven't done that, then you're not in a relationship with Christ. This is what it means. This is what it means to become saved, is to receive this gift, not as a result of works. So if he's not talking about earning your salvation, what does work out your salvation mean? I think Gary mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but that verb work out literally means to mine out. There was an author named Strabo who used this verb around the same time to describe bringing silver ore out of a mining operation, bringing it from inside up to the surface. And that's really what he's talking about. He's talking about the salvation you already have, that you've already received, and bringing that up into the surface, making it operational in your life, having it permeate every aspect of your life, taking it from the inside and bringing it to the surface. Now, some people have, responding to this, wanting to make it clear that God's at work in them, have done things like this. You know, you get the minivan with all these bumper stickers. Now, I would caution against this. Definitely not something I would do, because if there's one place I offend more people than just about anywhere else, it's on the back bumper of my car when I'm like too slow to leave a red light. I do not want to associate Christ with anything that has anything to do with my car. I bum too many people out with the way I drive. And other people, you know, they want to do other things to make it clear they're Christians. You guys remember who this is? This is from the 80s. This is a Christian heavy metal band, a big hair band called Striper. Yeah, Striper. So he's got the cross hanging around that chain there. He's got the cross on his cheek. I don't think this is what Paul had in mind. I'm just saying. What Paul has in mind when he says work out your salvation is something much more pervasive, much more extensive. He's not slapping a couple coats of paint over the rust in your life. He wants to work a transformation that touches everything you do from the inside out. That's what he wants to do. That's why it says that God is at work in you, both the will and the work for his good pleasure. You see, this idea of working out your salvation, gradually overcoming the sin in our lives and becoming more like Christ, so much so that people can see it on the outside, you're not left alone to do that. This is something you cooperate with God to do as he works this process in your life. You've received God's life when you became a Christian, and he's living in you, and the impetus to change is coming from him. He's committed to this process in your life. And so we're going to look at a specific area, a specific part of our life where God wants us to work out our salvation. And it's not the only one, but it's an important one. And so we're going to study that and just kind of walk through what Paul's talking about. So let's read this passage. Paul starts out, he says, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you'll prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I'll have reason to glory because I did not run in vain or toil in vain." He says, "But even if I'm being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. You too, I urge you, rejoice the same way and share your joy with me." Okay, just like we saw in the first two verses, this paragraph has a very obvious main command. It's do all things without grumbling and disputing. That's the main focus. This is the area of our lives where Paul wants to see us work out our salvation and see that process of transformation. And so all we're going to do is talk about what does he mean by grumbling and disputing? What's the positive alternative to living that way? What happens when we cooperate with God in this area? And then how can we do it? How can we actually live this way? That's it. That's pretty much all we're going to cover. So what is grumbling and disputing? Grumbling just means to murmur, to mutter, or complain about something. The Greek word is gagasmus, and it's onomatopoeic. I think that's the right way to say it. It means that the word sounds like what it means. Gagasmus, 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 gagasmus. You know, you're just walking around upset, angry. I was really fortunate earlier this year. I got to go skiing in Vail. I've only skied once in my life, like when I was a teenager. I had some relatives that invited me to come stay with them, me and my family. And so I get up to Vail, and I'm taking skiing lessons because I don't know what to do. And in Vail, the lessons are on top of the mountain. And so there's this wide, flat area. I'm standing with my classmates, surrounded by Rocky Mountain majesty. Just everywhere you look, splendor, sun, you know, brilliant snow. There was 5 inches of powder had fallen the night before. It's like the just quintessential skiing conditions. And the woman next to me goes, "I hate to ski in powder. I hate skiing in powder. Why do we have to have this powder?" And I'm just like, wow. Whoa. I mean, how can you have a crisis in a setting like this? How can you mumble and murmur and grumble in a situation like that? Just nuts. I couldn't believe it. Grumble, we see this a lot. Like, this is a manager that can't be satisfied with his employees, that just is always noticing what they're doing wrong. Or this is the person in your life that has never had a good day at work. Every day sucks. They're always getting, you know, given jobs they don't want to do, mistreated and disrespected. And I have a little personal experience with grumbling. At Christmas, my sister and I decided before we opened our presents, we would stack them in towers to see whose tower was the highest. So she stacks her tower, and I stack mine, and hers was like a foot taller. And these were like almost touching the ceiling. That's how massive amount, too many presents. And so I look at her and I look at my parents. And I'm like, I'm looking at how her tower is higher. And I just kind of, I'm just stomping out of the room, just, I can't believe this. It's pathetic. It's terrible. It's classic grumbling. That was a year ago, and I'm more mature now. I've made progress. No, that was a long time ago. So this is what grumbling is, right? Let me say a couple extra things about this. It's essentially selfish. It's my goals are blocked. I'm not being treated the right way. It's very focused on how I'm affected negatively by the circumstances I'm in. It happens all the time. Everywhere you look, we see grumbling. We see grumbling in good situations and in bad situations, in every walk of life with every kind of person. Nothing could be more typical, especially in a country like this, than people grumbling. And it is a super hard habit to break. Some of you probably feel like you've got a PhD in grumbling. I'd say I'm a tenured professor. I've been teaching people how to grumble for like 10 years now. Now, this is hard. This is super difficult to overcome. Think about just go a day without grumbling. Really hard to do. But this is where God says, work out your salvation because I'm at work in you. Right? This is an area where he can bring about transformation in your life. What about disputing? This is a combative line of reasoning that seeks to destroy. If you read in the Gospels, you'll see the Pharisees and the Sadducees fighting with Jesus. They're sitting on the sidelines not to learn, not so that his teaching can change their life. The word Luke uses is that they're disputing with Jesus. What are they doing there? They're plotting to kill him. That's what they're doing. That's what disputing is about. It's finding a way to strike out against somebody through some line of argument, something that we verbalize. Like grumbling, it's selfish and self-promoting. It occurs in every area of life. We see this again at the workplace and families when couples are striking out against each other. And we see it in the church. It's interesting. We have a lot of home churches, our home Bible studies and our fellowship. And a lot of them are great. Most of them are great. But in a church this size, sometimes leadership teams will fall apart. And we'll have to help the people in that group find a new group to go to. And we studied this a while back. Like, what is the biggest reason why groups lose their way? And you'd think it would be something like, you know, marriage is falling apart or some kind of immorality or addiction or something like that that comes into the leader's life. It's not it. The number one thing that people run into, leadership teams, is disputing. This more than anything else has broken up leadership teams in our church because this is the way people are. This is a very common thing that we all wrestle with. It's also, I want to say, this is different than disagreeing. Sometimes when people are talking about an issue they care for, they'll have different opinions, and they'll express those, and they'll debate those, and that's normal, and that's actually unavoidable and totally healthy. Disputing happens when, in the course of disagreeing, somebody's feelings get hurt, and then trying to solve a problem or take the next step forward becomes, I want to attack you because you've hurt me, right? And so that's when you shift from a simple disagreement to what the Bible would call disputing. Both of these things are toxic. We know people that are this way. We know how we've affected people when we've been this way. These are things that God wants to deliver us from. He wants to turn us on to a different way to live. This is an area where he wants us to work out our salvation as he works in us. And so I want to look at that. I want to look at what the positive alternative is. What is the positive alternative to grumbling and disputing? How about avoid irritating people and keep your mouth shut? How about that? Now, I mean, yeah, walk around with your hand over your mouth. Maybe that's it. No, I don't think that's going to work. If you look at the positive alternative in this passage, it's really something like this. It's finding joy through serving people, finding joy through serving people is the alternative to grumbling and disputing that Paul puts out. We already read this, but we'll read it again. He says, even if I'm being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. You too, I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me. So what does he say here? He, reflecting on his own life, he says, I'm being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith. He's saying, in order to help the Philippians grow closer to God, he's being poured out. And he's describing what the Jews used to do when they would pour wine on the altar at the temple as an offering, a thank offering to God. Paul's saying, that's me. I've spent myself. I've poured myself out in your service as a thank offering to God, as a response to what he's done with me. And he says, you know what? I rejoice in that. I get a deep sense, a kind of a stable, independent of circumstances sense of joy. And we've seen this all through Philippians. This is the main theme of the book, joy in the midst of the Christian life as we step out and serve other people. All through this book, Paul is connecting serving other people with joy. And I realize, if you're grumbling and disputing, this seems really counterintuitive. You know, when you're kind of in a dark place, the last thing you want to do, the last thing you feel like you could even have the strength to do, is to get somebody else's needs and concerns in your radar screen and focus on that. It just seems almost literally impossible when you're grumbling and disputing, when you're in that mindset to live this way. But Paul's like, nah, this is the way forward, joy through service. And I'll tell you, I don't know if you've been in situations where you've been in a bad mood and you've been forced to step up and serve, and then you've seen the impact and how cool it is. Have you ever been in a situation like that? I was in one about 16 years ago. I was on a flight to Cambodia. It's actually two flights. We had stopped over in Malaysia, and then we were taking off from there. And I was sleep deprived. I was, you know, 12 hours off my schedule. The whole journey took like 32 hours. I forget. It was just one of the longest trips I think I've ever taken. And so I was looking forward when I got into the plane going from Malaysia to Cambodia. I was like, cool, I'll get to chill out and sleep in my seat. And so I sit down, and this super perky, chatty woman who happened to speak English sits next to me, and she wants to talk. She's like, so where are you headed? Cambodia. What are you doing there? Missions trip. And I'm just trying to give her the shortest possible answers, kind of gently, maybe not so gently, letting her know, I really don't want to talk right now. And so she was pressed ahead. She's like, well, what about this trip? Tell me more about what you're trying to accomplish. Oh, you're a Christian. Well, I've been actually looking into Christianity. What, you know, I've learned a few things, but tell me your take on it. And pretty soon I found myself, against my will really at first, in a great discussion with somebody who was very close to becoming a Christian. I got to explain how I came out of a pretty secular background and became a Christian, why I was persuaded that Christianity was true, how it was possible to know him on the basis of faith in Christ, not works we do. And at the end of that talk, she was like, you know, I think I'm going to go back to my hotel room tonight and start my relationship with Christ. I was like, what? I was just, this is one of those things you read about in a book that actually happened to me once. So if you've been through that kind of situation, there's something clarifying and sobering about helping somebody. There's something that kind of makes the petty disputes and things that we grumble about just seem stupid, right? It just kind of puts it in perspective. And this is what Paul is putting forth for them. Not just an alternative to grumbling and disputing, but an antidote. Living to serve people and finding joy in that. Something so powerful. It's not just an alternative. It actually expels and pushes out this kind of grumbling and disputing attitude. That's what he's saying is the positive alternative, finding joy through serving others. Now, one of my favorite examples of this in the life of Paul, and this doesn't get talked about much, so I wanted to bring this up here, is an episode that happens with Paul in Acts 27. He gets put on a boat in Caesarea by the Roman government. They're sending him to Rome to stand trial before Caesar. And so he gets on this boat and he follows along the shore, and the boat arrives at Myra. At Myra, he switches ships. They put him on an Egyptian grain ship headed for Rome. And the ship travels on to Crete. And at Crete, Paul, who was kind of a well-known passenger, who spent some time talking to the captain, he pleads with the captain, look, it's October, the weather's turning bad, we're going to run into storms if we continue. Can we just hang out in Crete for the winter? Can we stay here? And the captain totally blows him off and says, no, we're going to continue the voyage. And so they do. And sure enough, like Paul predicted, as they get out into this part of the Mediterranean, they get hit by this really bad storm that lasts several weeks. They're blown adrift for like 2 weeks. And they're throwing their supplies overboard, and they're throwing their rations out. They hardly have any food left. Challenging situation, especially for Paul, who had warned him this is the very thing that's going to happen. And you know what's funny? If you read Acts 27, he does let him know, I told you guys. He couldn't resist. He actually says, I told you so. So, you realize Paul is just like us. He has the same struggles. But you also see him fighting to serve people and to put their needs first in this challenging situation. At one point it says, Paul was encouraging them all to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day that you've been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation, for not a hair from the head of any of you will perish. And having said this, he broke bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all. And he broke it and he began to eat. And so here's a guy who decides, I'm just going to focus on helping people. And then, maybe with the wind whistling through the tackle and waves breaking and stuff, he's shouting above all of that to everybody that'll listen, and he thanks God. And if you know anything about Paul, he was long-winded. This probably went on for a little bit, just extolling God for the different ways he cares for us. He thanked God in their presence. Something really striking. He didn't grumble and dispute and poison the whole atmosphere with how frustrated he was. He did this instead. And it says all of them were encouraged and they took food. And if you go on, you can read, the ship crashes on Malta. Everyone survives. They get on the island. And even during the winter that they spend in Malta, you see Paul like gathering sticks to make a fire to keep people warm, going to homes where people are sick and healing them. You see him purposing to serve people and people coming to Christ as a result. There's just something really striking about living this way. There really is. And that's what I want to get into next, is just how powerful deciding to live this way can be. Rejecting grumbling and disputing and pursuing service instead. Paul says, what happens when we cooperate this way? He says, you'll prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world. That's what'll happen. Now, I want to get into what that means, but think about this for a second. Why would Paul even need to talk about not grumbling and not disputing? It's because it happens a lot. It was happening at Philippi. And it, like we've said already, it happens at work, it happens in sports, in politics, in our families. It's nothing could be more typical of what he calls a crooked and perverse generation. We're just as messed up as they were. Nothing could be more typical than people responding to challenging situations by grumbling and disputing. That is the norm. That is kind of the black backdrop that Paul has in mind when he challenges them to live a different way. You ever been to a jewelry store? Why do they put diamonds on black velvet? Why do they do that? Maybe they want that contrast. They want to see that diamond pop so it'll stand out and you'll want to buy it. And this is what Paul is saying, is he's saying there's an opportunity to stand out, to be striking, to be so different, to obviously have something going on inside you that is so out of step with the normal way people are that people take note. You guys remember this? This was 1989 when protesters in China were in Tiananmen Square protesting the government. You know, the Chinese government responded with this overwhelming military response here, and a lot of people crumbled, but this guy didn't. This guy stood in front of this whole line of tanks. And you see, I remember seeing that and being deeply struck by that, and I'll always remember that image. Here's another one. This is in the World Trade Centers in a stairwell. I'm not sure which tower it was in. But I remember seeing things like this during 911. Everyone's going down to safety, but that firefighter is going up to make sure people are safe, up into danger. I remember seeing another scene. I looked all over for it. I couldn't find it. There's a picture of clouds of ash rolling away from the building down the street. And you see everyone streaming away from the building and four or five firemen going to it to help people. That's powerful. There's just something about witnessing somebody marching to the beat of a different drummer that's got a different set of values, that has God's life in them, directing them to not grumble and dispute, but instead to find joy in service. People take note when that happens. This is what he says. He says, "You'll prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach. You'll appear against this dark background as lights in the world." And he's not talking about a finger wagging, holier than thou type of contrast. What he's saying is, it's going to be really hard to criticize somebody who lives this way. This is a site of an ancient bonfire that archaeologists dug up. This bonfire was lit during the plagues of Cyprian, which was about 250 to 270 AD. It's named after Cyprian because he was a bishop at the time, and most of what we know about this plague comes from him and a few other authors. During the height of the plague, Cyprian says about 5,000 people a day were dying in Rome. There's people dying all over the place. And so they were making these mass bonfires and just heaving people's corpses on top of them to sanitize cities. And we've dug it up, and that's how we know about it. Anyhow, one thing that historians will tell you is that pagan families, during these plagues, if one of their family members got sick, they'd put them out on the street because they didn't want to get infected. And Christians who were actually accused of causing this plague dispelled that rumor, one, by dying themselves of the plague, and two, by being one of the only groups of people that would go out into the street, collect these sick people, and bring them into their own homes to nurse them to health. This was typical of early Christians. 100 years earlier in the Antonine Plague, Christians did the very same thing. They stayed in the cities and cared for the sick while everybody else took off. And historians will tell you, you know, when they're like, what were some of the engines that drove the growth of the early church? This was one of them. It was the way Christians behaved, the striking difference in their behavior during the plague. If you fast forward up to today, you know, we had a modern epidemic, an Ebola epidemic in Africa. And I don't know if you caught on the news that Christians were really at the spear point of addressing that problem. Christian missionaries with health organizations already on the ground did a tremendous amount of good to help stop the spread of Ebola. This led some authors, like this guy, Brian Palmer, who are not real sympathetic to Christianity, to write articles like this. He wrote, "Should we worry that so many of the doctors treating Ebola in Africa are missionaries? Should we be troubled by that?" He was writing from an atheist perspective. He didn't like the idea of Christians coming to the bedside of a sick person and using that moment of weakness to try to tell them about Christ. And he wrote a long article about it. At one point he admits, "You know, I don't feel good about missionary medicine, even though I can't fully articulate why." He's like, "There's undeniably good, but there's something about this that bugs me." But as he researched what Christians were doing, as he studied how in country after country, government healthcare systems were collapsing and failing, and how, you know, different Christian organizations were making a huge difference on the ground, this was his conclusion. It's a reluctant conclusion, but this is what he said. "As an atheist, I try to make choices based on evidence and reason. So until we're finally ready to invest heavily in secular medicine for Africa, I suggest we stand aside and let God do his work." You know, you don't hear that kind of thing from guys like that very often. And, you know, a bumper sticker or some weird clothing, or, you know, never cussing or wagging your finger at people. Is that going to provoke this kind of response? No. What provokes it is Christians who find joy in service, who are so struck by what they've been given by God that this is the way they live. They forsake grumbling and disputing for this. That makes a difference. That stands out. So, yeah, wow. That's a high bar, no doubt. And that's the first thing I want to say about how can we live this way, is just let this soak in. What is it that we're being called to do? This is such a high bar. Think back to the early part of chapter 2. What did Paul call us to do? He said, "Do nothing from selfishness." Nothing. Not sometimes. He's like, "Do nothing from selfishness. With humility of mind, regard each other as more important than yourselves." That's right, service, putting other people first. He says in later, he says, "Have this attitude, this serving attitude in yourselves, which is also in Christ, who humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." That's what those Christians during the plague were doing. They were so intent to serve, they were willing to die to do it. That's what Jesus did. That's what we're called to do. At the end of this passage, look how he says, at the end of our passage, he says, "You too, I urge you to rejoice in the same way." What is he saying? He's like, this isn't a lifestyle for a professional class of Christians. This isn't just for Mother Teresa or like a, you know, a certain select group of people that have followed God for decades. This is for you. This is the normal Christian life. This is what he calls you to. Nothing less than pouring our life out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of other people's faith. Nothing less than that. This is one thing the Bible, you know, God never waters down the call to radical discipleship. But we got to remember that God's at work in us. You know, you might even today run into a situation that's challenging, and you know, you're just tempted to fire up the grumble and dispute machine like you always do. And you're going to, you know, in those moments, you know, what do we do to cope with that? I think we have to go to God and say, "I know you can help me live a different way. I affirm that you're at work in me." And he says two things that God's willing to do in the moment where we get to decide how we're going to respond. Paul says that God is at work in us to will and to work for his good pleasure. The word "will" there, it's really the idea is to strengthen our desire. He's not going to make a decision for us, but he can energize us and strengthen our desire to do what's right. And it says he's at work in us. He's able to give us the energy and drive to do it. The resources are there, but we have to pause in the moment, affirm to God that they are there, and appeal to Him to help us out. That's so crucial to living this type of lifestyle. It's a lifestyle of day-to-day dependence. Another thing we got to do is hold fast to the Word of Life. I wasn't able to explain this before, but see how the big command is do all things without grumbling or disputing? Why are we supposed to do this? We already talked about that. So that we'll be innocent and blameless, blah, 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 blah. We haven't said much about how. How do we do all things without grumbling or disputing? By holding fast to the Word of Life. This is a key part of this lifestyle. Holding fast to the Word of Life. Now, you know, the textbook case of grumbling and disputing, I've got to at least bring it up, in the Bible, happened in the Old Testament when the Jews were grumbling and disputing. This is actually, this is the language that Paul's using. He's referring back to that. The Jews had been out in the wilderness, and God had spoken. He had given him his Word of Life. He'd said, I'm going to take you to the promised land. I will provide for you. I will help you defeat your enemies. But the Jews didn't believe it. They didn't believe the Word of Life. It says they grumbled in their tents and said, because the Lord hates us, He's brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. What was the Jews' problem? What was keeping them out of the land? Was it that their situation was hopeless? Or was it that God was impotent and unable to do anything? No, it wasn't any of those things. It's this. They were grumbling because they believed the lie that God hated them. After everything He had done to demonstrate by parting the Red Sea, by feeding them with manna and giving them water, everything He had done, they conclude, nah, that guy hates us. Let's just try to be honest with ourselves here. How many of us could trace our grumbling and disputing, if we follow the thread all the way back to this feeling we have deep down that God hates us, that God isn't good, that we're an orphan, that we're out on our own, and that we're just going to have to figure things out because we've been abandoned? When we aren't holding on to the words of life, when you start thinking this way, grumbling and disputing is what happens. It's just inevitable. And so the words of life, if you want this new lifestyle, we've got to hold on to them. Here's a couple words of life. How about this? This is God's track record with you. He showed His great love for you by sending Christ to die for you while you were still sinners. If you're here far from God, what's God's posture towards you? He sent His own Son to pay for your sin by having Him die on a cross. He's ready to receive you right now when you put your faith in Him. If you're a Christian, that's how God has dealt with you. That says a lot about His character. How about this? Once we're believers, Christ says, I'm with you always. Always. Even to the end of the age. Anything you face for the rest of your life, you will never face it alone. You'll have Christ through the Holy Spirit present with you in all those moments. Or what about this? You know, when you're facing adversity, Paul says, what should we say to these things? If God's for us, who is against us? He who didn't spare His own Son, but delivered Him over for us all, how will He not also with Him freely give us all things? We could go on for hours like this, hours, listing God's words of life. And it would have, I think, if we could live in this thought world, it would release the grip of grumbling and disputing, no doubt about it. So let me ask you this. If you feel like you've really been in the tank in this area, are you suffering from chronic underexposure to the Word of Life? That's part of the problem. This is part of finding our way out of this, is getting these promises under our belt, getting ourselves in front of what God says. All right, a couple final thoughts. First, and you're maybe some of us are feeling this, grumbling and disputing is hard on relationships. Some of us are feeling the strain of that right now in marriages or at work or whatever. We can just tell We can maybe look back and see some of the damage that this has done. And if you're sitting here and you feel like, wow, this is what I needed to hear. God is really putting his finger on this. I would urge you, if you're sensing that this is a problem, to ask God to show it to you. And what I mean by that is to tell God, help me see the full extent, the full toxicity of what I've been into. Because odds are there's a lot more going on here than you realize. And so just asking God, you know, help sensitize me to how this is affecting my life. And then as the information comes trickling in and you start to get a clear picture of what a pervasive issue this can be in your life, I would own it. It's tempting to try to attribute the grumbling and disputing to the challenging situations you're in. That's not owning it. I would say, how about this? Something like this. My grumbling and disputing is my issue. It's not the inevitable result of my circumstances. This is something I'm choosing to do. I have an alternative. And then, and we've talked about this. You've got to really just take comfort in the fact that you're not alone. God's at work in you to give you the desire and the energy, the power to live a different way. And we have to keep looking to him over and over again. And then lastly, I think it's just crucial. We've got to affirm the way forward is finding joy through service. It's not just the alternative. It is the antidote to grumbling and disputing. So, all right. That's Philippians 2, 14 through 18.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.